Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Having a child with a severe emotional or behavioral problem is a challenging thing for a family. Where should you turn to find help? And what should you expect from treatment providers working with your child? The topic of today's program is early childhood mental health, with a special focus on how therapists use play to help children heal from trauma and other mental health conditions. Today's guest, Lori Houston, has been healing children and teens and adults with play, expressive arts, skills, mindfulness, and EMDR in the Matsu Valley for 22 years. Fostering healthy attachments and using neurobiology as the foundation of therapy, Lori creates a fun, safe environment to heal from trauma or work through life stressors that are causing anxiety or depression. Lori is the president of the Alaska Association for Play Therapy, a registered play therapy supervisor, and a state of Alaska LPC supervisor. Lori, thanks for taking the time to join me today.
Sure.
Need to remind our listeners that you can reach us locally with questions or comments for Lori by calling 550-8433. That's 550-8433, our local phone number. Or if you're outside of Anchorage, you can reach us on our toll-free line at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. If you haven't emailed in, you got to spell out line one. That's line1@alaskapublic.org. If you have a question or comment about today's topic, want to get pick Lori's brain about your child or questions about adolescent or child mental health, please feel free to give us a call. Your questions always liven things up and give us some good stuff to talk about. Okay, I guess let's get into it. Lori, you and I kind of go way back. We should disclose, I mean, 1995 is when I moved up here and we were working at LifeQuest together.
That's right.
Can you give us a little bit of your background with children and adolescents, what you've been doing in the Valley?
So I got my master's degree in social work and really found a love for working with kids in my internship and my first introduction to play therapy. And I was very fortunate to have a really positive experience with a really knowledgeable supervisor in Washington. And when I moved back home to Alaska, I started working in the Valley and quickly learned that there was a lot to learn working with kids, but I really enjoyed it. And so I've been working in the Valley for 23 years now, actually, and have been at a couple of different agencies. And what I really found in the Valley was that we needed a place to, a go-to place to heal trauma and anxiety and depression for kids. And so I co-own a business called Playful Journeys out in the Valley. And
with Brian Albright.
With Brian Albright, yeah. Yes. And it's an exciting time for the Valley because we see a lot of children and see a lot of healing happen within a very short period of time.
We have a good deal of trauma and substance abuse and domestic violence in Alaska. And, you know, I do think it's imperative that people understand the impacts of early childhood sort of adverse experiences. And that's something we're going to talk a little bit more about and something that Dr. Witter is going to follow up on next week with his show on about the ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, in the Valley. So that'll be interesting to hear the statistics on how the work that's going on out in the Valley with childhood trauma and early childhood exposure to significant events. So what kind of things are you seeing? You do play therapy. I guess maybe we should start with talking about play therapy because that's a very misunderstood form intervention. And it's a thing. I mean, it's not just playing in a sandbox and dressing up dolls. I mean, there's a lot of people that can play with children, but play therapy as a discipline. Can you talk about that?
Right. So there's a national association, which is called the Association for Play Therapy, and it is the guiding credentialing body for play therapists. And there's actually a credentialing program that you go through to get your hours of training and supervision. And it requires 500 hours of doing play therapy while you're being supervised, 50 hours by a registered play therapy supervisor. and it requires 150 hours of play therapy approved coursework to get continuing education credits. And so it's actually a pretty intensive process to go through to get this credential or this certification. And so, but with that, you can learn about the different theoretical orientations, just like as in adult therapy, and how to apply them with kids. And so it would be really important for parents to understand that there is a certification process out there, and that the therapist providing therapy for their child should have some training in this area, if not be a registered play therapist.
If somebody calls themselves a play therapist or says they do play therapy, if they claim that, then they must or they should have the certification, right? You should be able to ask if they have certain certifications.
Right. If somebody is saying they are a play therapist because it's a national certification, then they should have be pursuing at least the training hours and understand the process. There are a lot of people who have toys in their office, and the toys do right. absolutely help kids to be able to express themselves, but they should be able to explain the process and where they're at in it.
I have some toys in my office, and people come in, they're like, oh, you do play therapy? And I said, no, those are for the siblings of the teenagers that I work with, so they can be distracted. That's different than play therapy.
That's very different than play therapy, yes.
Okay, so what's the theory behind play therapy? I mean, it's not just play. There's a healing. There's a flow to it. There's something specifically that you're looking for doing, because kids are super, like, I mean, it's easy to influence their thoughts, or you have to be careful not to guide that, I assume.
You do. So children look to adults for approval. They look to adults to please them. They look to adults for many relational things. And so you have to be super careful to not guide them and to be able to really understand what you're doing. Play is important because it's a kid's natural language, and they learn problem solving and social skills and all sorts of things through play. And what children cannot say with their words, they express with toys. And toys provide the child also with really critical distance from difficult emotional material that they might be experiencing. They also allow the children some control over what's going on. So instead of being able to talk about it and like an adult would, then we might use puppets to role play what's happening at school for them. We might create a scene in the sand tray that might help them have some power and mastery over their experiences. So themes and patterns begin to emerge that can give insight into those the child's experiences and how they have developed in their brain to get them to where they are today, which is in my office with some obviously really difficult experiences going on, or they wouldn't be seeing a therapist.
So what is it that parents bring their kids to you about? I mean, what are the kinds of things that you're seeing? Because there's all sorts of troublesome behavior in children, and that's well within the quote unquote normal, continuum for childhood behavior. But what are you seeing in the office that triggers parents to bring them in?
So by the time parents bring their kids to me, we have some pretty significant acting out, whether at school or at home. Parents will experience defiant behavior, maybe lying, maybe being excessively harmful to siblings or pets. They may experience not wanting to go to school or stomach aches, headaches, sudden drop in grades. All of a sudden, they don't have any friends, or it's typically by the time parents bring kids to me, we're seeing a pretty significant decrease in functioning.
There is some sort of interruption in their day-to-day operations, either at home or at school, that's causing lots of significant problems, teachers, peers.
Yes.
That kind of stuff. All right. And so you get, where are your referrals coming from? I mean, how do people get to you? Like, you have what's the age group you work with first off?
I've seen kids as young as 18 months all the
18
way.
18 months?
Yeah, all the way up to, I mean, I see adults now, but typically kids will come back at different developmental stages. And sometimes now I'm old enough that I'm seeing kids now that are 28, and I saw them first when they were 12.
Soon you're going to be seeing their kids.
Don't say that.
That's next, right? All right, so they get to you, and what's the assessment process? You got, I mean, six-year-olds are not really great at expressing, you know, this is what I'm dealing with, this is what I'm feeling. And so what's the assessment process involved?
Well, so let me just kind of back up and talk about parents will often first consult with their pediatrician. And so we get a lot of referrals from pediatricians. We also get referrals from the school because behaviors will come up in the school. And so oftentimes parents will come with a whole list of presenting problems or unwanted behaviors that are causing them to be concerned. And, you know, six-year-olds are not great at it or four-year-olds are not great at it, but we do what's called a child-friendly assessment, which decreases a child's defenses. And I talk to them about sometimes you have big things that happen in your life that cause yucky feelings. And I tell kids I have the best job in the whole world because mm-hmm. I get to talk and play and help kids all day long. And they come into my office and what they see immediately puts them at ease. I mean, they see shelves of sand tray figurines and miniatures. They see puppets. They see art supplies. They see lots of different fidget objects right next to them. So if they need to, you know, fidget, then they can. And so we do probably the first two sessions is interview style, just so I can see their verbal skills, see their cognitive abilities, and see their attention span, and see parents be able to set limits with them. And so I try to do as much verbal as I can in a very child-friendly way. I ask them questions that help me learn what's important to them and what they like to do and how their friends are. And so through this assessment, then I find out, you know, oh, that might be a problem that you want to not have in your life, right? And that's how we begin to develop presenting problems instead. Whereas if you're an adult and you're going into therapy, they're going to say, why did you come to see me today?
Right.
And you can say that, but kids can't. And so I may use what we call a family play genogram by Eliana Gill, and the kids may choose different miniatures to be representative of the different people in their world. And then they can talk about each person and why they chose that figurine to represent their mom or their dad or their teacher or other people important in their world. So a child-friendly assessment really helps.
The parents' involvement in this, like, obviously these behaviors and the challenges weren't created in a vacuum. So you can't work with kids without working with the parents, right?
So I don't. Many therapists do when they work with kids. And my preference is to always work with the parents because I work with children 1 hour a week and parents have them 167 other hours of the week. And so I can't do this work without them. And children, they're going to be in their life forever and they're their attachment figures. And the parents need to understand what their children are feeling and how they go about helping their children to understand their feelings and problem solve their feelings, because that's really how things get stored in the brain in such a mismatched way that they get mixed up thoughts about themselves. And then that perpetuates negative behaviors. And so if parents can be there for their children and hear it in a safe way, then it's much more helpful.
Yeah, I think it's a super good point, like an hour a week. I mean, I work with parents a lot, and one of the things, the feedback that I give them is that, the same as you, like you have them every day, all day. The more that you can begin to incorporate this and understand how they're feeling, obviously you can't have the same conversations with your kids that I get to as a teenager. I mean, I tell parents that all the time. I get to have conversations with your kids that you wish you could have because they're insightful and they're bright. But the parents' role in younger children is even more important. I mean, that's so much of that healing has to take place at home, right?
Yes, so much of it does, because the entire foundation of the brain is based on attachment. And so if there's some disruptions in the attachment relationship with your child, then the events that are occurring on a day-to-day basis with your child are not going to get stored in ways that are going to impact development of the brain.
Okay, take just a second. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is child and adolescent therapist Lori Houston. On today's show, we are discussing childhood mental health and looking at how therapists use play to help children heal. If you have a question for Lori or an experience you want to share about childhood mental health or any sort of thing you may have done as a child or with your child, please call in and share that with us. That'd be great. The ways to reach us, our local phone number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, you mentioned a really important word. You said attachment. Let's take a couple of seconds to talk about attachment theory, what that means, why it's important.
So attachment begins obviously at birth, and when parents feed, nurture, rock, stare into the eyes of their child, really important things are happening in the brain from 0 to 1. That brainstem is really fully developing, helping all the autonomic systems of the body work right. And then from 1 to 3, the emotional brain begins to develop. And that's when your kids are having tantrums and meltdowns and parents are providing comfort and support. And they begin to learn self-regulation. And kids cannot learn self-regulation until other regulation has occurred in the brain. And so it begins to develop in layers. What's challenging for parents in the attachment theory is that their children's behaviors trigger their own fear about being good parents or bad parents or what their child is going to develop into. And so parents then begin to react and respond just to the behaviors the child is having versus their feelings. And one of the interesting things that I can share out of 23 years of experience is that when parents really truly get it and can take recommendations from a therapist about how to respond to their child's feelings and really be present for them to help them sort out most critically feelings between in their relationship with their child, kids' behaviors do a 180-degree turnaround. I mean, it's very, very... it's that remarkable.
Yeah, kids respond really quickly to parents' intervention and to that. But see, I hear all the time, like, what's the most important stage? And, you know, parents say, well, what about 1 to 3? If it's not established there, can you do this repair work, the nurturing work? Can you do, like, the attachment stuff with kids later if they've missed it early?
You can, and it's part of a child therapist's job is to help parents to really understand that you can do that. I work with a lot of parents who have had children separated at birth because of medical complications in as an infant. I work with a lot of moms who have gone through postpartum depression and were not able to bond with their child, and so we've gone back and done what is now called neurosequential model of therapeutics from Dr. Bruce Perry. And it really works at the different stages of development of the brain. And you meet that child where that child's at. So we may give recommendations to go and do some bottle feeding or some rocking or some eye contact or finger food eating to be able to help those lower regions of the brain develop where they didn't get developed.
Yeah, because each stage has its own set of things tasks that a young person has to accomplish in order to move to the next developmental stage, right? You have certain things that you need to accomplish.
Yes, and it helps also with the interconnectivity between the brain regions so that the brain can work together as it's supposed to.
All right. Can you talk a little bit? You've mentioned neurobiology quite a few times. And what exactly does that mean as far as, I mean, you think neurobiology, you break them down, you can figure out brain and nature, right? Like, but what is that in the context that you're using it?
Well, kids are born with their own unique neurological makeup, which can lead to their temperament and then therefore their behaviors, and then how parents respond or react further aids in that brain development. But what's really exciting with the brain and body research in this last decade that's really guiding the practice of child therapy, it's very helpful in figuring out, if you can figure out how something is stored in someone's brain and then use neurobiology to help them process memory and then help them find resolution, it's really critical. So what happens is our brain processes events that occur through all of our senses. And then if it's processed in a healthy way, upsetting events, then it gets integrated into neural memory and the child develops positive core beliefs about themselves. For example, I am lovable, I am worthwhile, I am safe. And then if they do not get processed in healthy ways, it acts much like an unhealed wound in the brain, and they walk around with core beliefs like, I am helpless, I am unsafe, I can't trust others. And then their behaviors come access of that memory node, and then they behave in ways that make those feel true. So the neurobiology of the brain, in just kind of a quick rundown, we have a right hemisphere and a left hemisphere. Our emotional brain is our right hemisphere, and our left hemisphere is our logic, problem solving, and reasoning, and that's up in the prefrontal cortex, which kids don't really have yet. And so they're connected by what we have called a corpus callosum. When something overwhelms our right hemisphere, that corpus callosum shuts down and we can't access that. So adults may recognize that process as, I'm frozen in fear, or I'm so angry I can't think straight. That's what's happening, is that your neural conduit between your hemispheres are shut down. So our amygdala, which is our survival component of our brain,
it's the fight or flight, the lizard brain kind of survival stuff.
Yes. Yes. We need that for when we actually need to survive. But the problem is we are so evolved now that our amygdala gets triggered for things like bullying or test anxiety or having to do a speech or talk on the radio. And yeah. So you get this amygdala that triggers. And then if these events get unprocessed from a healthy attachment figure, then what can happen is it just stores like these emotional wounds, and then it creates anxiety, depression, and things that, you know, bring kids to me eventually.
All right. I want to talk a little bit more about trauma and recovery from trauma for children. But let's talk a little bit more about like parents and their role in this recovery process for kids going through therapy. Like, why is it so important for parents to model this emotional regulation you talked about? You talk about kids don't have that piece that the sort of the governor on the brain, right, that taps the brakes. Why is it so important for parents to model this for their kids?
I think it's important for parents to model that because children don't have it. So if a child has a tantrum and screaming things at parents, for parents to be able to regulate themselves and to understand that it's not personal, this doesn't mean that the child is going to grow up being disrespectful and get fired from job after job after job, which is where oftentimes parents' brains go.
Uh-huh.
Parents need to be able to take a step back and to be able to say, ooh, let's calm you down first, and then we'll solve this problem, instead of overreacting. And then hurtful things get said, and then we have what's called a relational trauma. And one of the interesting parts about attachment is that it reacts when there's a disruption in attachment by hurtful words. It actually creates the same fight or flight as if the brain is being traumatized. Because as human beings, we are one of the mammals that require 100% dependency on our attachment figure. And so
For a long time,
for survival.
Yeah.
And so if when the brain experiences a disrupted attachment, it experiences fear of survival.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Now we're talking about neurobiology, right?
Yes. Because, sorry. It all goes back to neurobiology.
We are absolutely hardwired.
Yes.
And for survival depends on attachment. And if we all lived in caves and we were, you know, roaming the plains or whatever, if a child does not have that secure attachment figure, they're not going to survive.
Absolutely.
All right. So our society has evolved and we have technology and we have all these things, but I do not believe that our biology has evolved to the point where kids can just sit comfortably in a crib for hours and now they don't need attachment because they're all safe in their warm house, right? And there's no saber-toothed tiger. That hasn't changed.
No. No. And neglect can actually do more harm on the brain than abuse can because there's no attachment figure there. I mean, at least with abuse, there's an attachment figure there. It may be inconsistent and it may be traumatic, but it's much easier to repair a child's brain when it's abused than when it's neglected.
Why? That's interesting.
Because there's no adult figure to help them process their world if they're just left alone in their crib or alone without proper care for hours and days on end.
And the brain is stagnant. Their creativity is not happening. Attachment, feelings of love, connection.
Right. And just the building blocks of language and communication skills and emotional expression and problem solving and social skills, and nothing develops.
I read a story, it was a while ago, I don't remember where I read it, but it was about some children who had grown up in severe neglect, and they essentially were vacant.
Yes.
They quit crying because at some point you cry and you cry and you cry and your needs don't get met. You learn that, but there's no point.
Yes. When you look at fMRI scans of the brain of children who are neglected, you see a lot of dark area in regions of the brain that are just critical for survival.
Dark meaning there's no electrical activity. It's just sort of dormant. That doesn't evolve. Okay. I think we're at the halfway point in our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a quick break. I want to remind folks you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. My guest today is child and adolescent therapist Lori Houston. On today's show, we're discussing childhood mental health and looking at how therapists use play to help children heal. If you have a question for Lori or an experience you want to share about today's topic, you can reach us in three ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll return to our conversation with Lori Houston. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is child and adolescent therapist Lori Houston. On today's show, we're discussing childhood mental health and looking at how therapists use play to help children heal from trauma and other mental health conditions. If you have a question for Lori or an experience you want to share about today's topic, you can reach us in three ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Please remember the show repeats tonight at 8, so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we won't be accepting phone calls. I want to take just a moment to promote a showing of the documentary film Screenagers. I did a show with Dr. Delaney Rustin on April 14th about the show Screenagers, which is a film about kids growing up in the technological age. So there's going to be two screenings, one at the Beartooth on Friday, the 6th, I believe, is the date. Is that the date? I'll look. Friday, anyway, this Friday. And then next Wednesday at the Waldorf, Anchorage Waldorf School. So those are two showings of Screenagers. Kids are welcome. I believe it's $5 donation to help pay for the screening fees, but definitely worthwhile to watch with your kids. And I'll be moderating a discussion afterwards at both of those screenings. So Beartooth on Friday, bring your kid, listen to Screenagers. It's definitely worth the time. All right. So, one more thing about Screenagers. If you want more on that, you can go to screenagersmovie.com or go back to line one and listen to that show with Dr. Rustin. It was good. All right. So, Lori, we're here discussing childhood mental health. I mean, I've done a lot of shows on adolescent mental health. That's my wheelhouse. So, it's kind of easy for me to roll with that. But kids is not something I understand. I've had some 8-year-olds and some 9-year-olds, and it's funny you tell the story about the toys. I had one kid left my office just recently and looked over at the office across the way and said, "Can I see that therapist? He's got so many cool toys." Like, I think maybe he's a little young, but the toys do draw them in. Like, that is, the play is exciting for them and fun. And can you talk about the importance of fun in this recovery process and working with kids?
Right. It has to be fun. Kids can create stories, and stories can be fun. Obviously, the more trauma material that they're processing, the less fun it is.
Not so much
but,
fun.
But it's more fun than somebody trying to talk to them about it. Mm-hmm. And so the stories in the sand, or the stories in the dollhouse, or the stories with the puppets all create that environment of fun and play. And we can work through this, and it's not shameful. It's not horrible. You've got somebody that's holding your emotion in a safe space that's trained to help you process it. You've got you've got an attachment figure that is helping you understand it and in a different way. And when their stories get stuck, the therapist is there to help, you know, help them to be able to find different resources to bring into the play. Maybe Superman's going to come in this time, or maybe a fairy godmother, or, whatever resources that you may have. But children don't need to stay stuck in their stories.
That sounds like it's really teaching them that they can, I mean, you're teaching them to learn to create resources.
Yes, and you're challenging their core beliefs about the world that, you know, others aren't there to help them, or you're changing core beliefs about themselves to be able to develop power and mastery over whatever conflict is happening in their stories.
Do you see a lot of resistance with parents as far as bringing their kids to therapy, or their feelings about having to bring their child to therapy? Is that difficult for some parents?
I think it's really difficult for some parents because there seems to be some shame involved. And if I had one dream before I retire in this in this profession, it would be to help decrease that shame and for parents to be able to see mental health assessment for their child just as they see a physical health checkup for their child, because it really is truly one and the same. It's mental health is physical health. And the more that I can get that message out there for parents so that there isn't shame, and to get these problems addressed early so that children aren't struggling into their adolescent years and young adult years.
Yeah, the physical and the mental health. Dr. Woodard believes that it should be mandatory for everybody to have mental health insurance and then optional for physical health. Like, he thinks the primary thing is often the habits that we have, the behavior that is maladaptive, the attitudes of mind, our thoughts about the world, and that many of our, you know, I mean, kids have physical manifestations of this stuff. Obesity, dietary, like stomach problems, sick. I mean, the kids who tell you they're sick in the morning, I hear that a lot. My stomach hurts. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because a lot of parents think their kids are faking. Because there's no fever, there's no sickness. What's going on with those kids a lot of the time?
So because of the vagus nerve system and our stress response.
Now, the vagus nerve is the nerve in the stomach that connects to the brain. It goes from the stomach to the brain.
Right, and it's what communicates how the body is supposed to react. And so when the brain is overwhelmed with stress for children, what happens is all of the systems in your body that you don't need for fight or flight shut down and become depressed. And so your digestive system and your immune system and your reproductive system and all of those systems that are not necessary for running or fighting essentially shut down. And so that's why stomach acid will pool in the stomach and they will get stomach aches or tension headaches from just being overly stressed. And so I will see a lot of kids with those somatic complaints that
Getting they're getting triggered from school, and that's like often what I find with kids who don't want to go to school. And it happened with one of my own kids. She really didn't want to go to school because she didn't feel like she was as smart as the other kids, and she was struggling with reading and her stomach hurt, and she would have like almost panic attacks, high anxiety. I can't do it. I don't want to do it. And it manifested and it spread out into other areas of her life, frustrations with certain things. I tell this story because it was so incredibly healing, and maybe you can speak to it, but when we took her in to a therapist or a psychologist for testing, I'm a therapist, right? So I had some embarrassment about that. Like, I should be able to figure this out. It's an 8-year-old, but it's my kid, so I can't. And but there was some of that. I was going to see a peer who, you know, I know, and I'm asking for help with my kid. And I was kind of thinking, but what it did is it really empowered my child. It really gave her a safe place to process this stuff. She got feedback from adults who were compassionate and caring, and talked about her brain in different ways and her strengths and and weaknesses and how we can work on those things. And it's been a remarkable turnaround in 6 months, working with people who are specializing in the things that she's struggling with, reading. And she's had tremendous improvements in confidence, wants to go to school, excited about learning. So I share that experience because it really is important. I want parents to know the importance of early intervention. So can you speak a little bit about that? If you're hesitant and you're worried, what's the risk of going?
I don't see that there's any risk. I mean, the risk is you go and you get a therapist that maybe you don't connect with or your child doesn't connect with and you have a bad experience, but that would be the only risk. And so, you know, a best way to get your to get a good referral is to check out with your friends if they've gone to therapy, because a lot of families are sharing the same experiences that you are. And a lot of parents will consult with their pediatricians first. And pediatricians typically now and more we're going to an integrated model with medical and mental health. And so they may have a specific referral for a child therapist. You can go to the Association for Play Therapy, and they have a parent tab on their website. It's a4pt.org, and they have a parent tab on there, and you can find a therapist that has play therapy credentials to find a therapist. I'm a resource as well, and you can find my name and number at playfuljourneys.com.
We have that on our website, along with some other resources about play therapy and childhood mental health. But yeah, Playful Journeys, your website's a good resource if you're out in the valley or if you're in Anchorage and you have a question and you want to get an answer. Which reminds me, if you're just tuning in, my guest today is child and adolescent therapist Lori Houston. On today's show, we're discussing childhood mental health and looking at how therapists use play to help children heal. If you have a question for Lori or an experience you want to share about today's topic, You can reach us at our local phone number. It's 550-8433. Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. We have about 15 minutes left before we have to start getting off the air. So if you have a call, have a question you want to ask, go ahead and call in next 10 minutes and we'll be able to get you on the air. Okay, talking about trauma and parents, I do want to talk a little bit more about parents and the stigma and the shame. Like, what I think what parents will find if they ask around is that many people are struggling with issues. And part of the problem with stigma and mental health is that nobody talks about it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's got it.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody's talking about it. I don't know anybody that gets to their life without something.
Right. So there's what we call big T and little T traumas. And so big T traumas are obviously abuse or neglect or, you know, big events that really overwhelm the system and cause shame and embarrassment, and usually happen within the context of families, really intimate, such as domestic violence. And those are big T traumas. The little T traumas are things that could be just like bullying or a car accident or the loss of a really important grandparent or a pet. And those little T traumas can also build up and creating the same presentation as a big T trauma over the life of a child. And so, honestly, there are no shameful reasons to avoid counseling. I think that getting the support of a therapist while your family's going through whatever it's going through, a therapist's office is a non-judgmental healing place for parents to turn to for that support.
Yeah, it is. It if they have the right therapist, then the right it's the right match. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of that? Because I think that it can't be over. I mean, it's super important, the quality of that relationship. Why is that so important? I mean, if your surgeon, if you don't get along with your surgeon, that's fine. He's going to cut on you and go away, and that's done. But this relationship therapeutically is really the primary thing, research indicates.
Right. So you're exactly right. The research does indicate that it's the relationship. And again, that goes back to attachment. Our whole brain is designed to attach. And so if you don't feel safe and connected, and what we're calling, what Dan Siegel now is calling feeling felt. So if a person feels felt, then they are much more likely to continue to process difficult information and be more vulnerable and be able to accept the feedback that you're giving them. And so the tricky part for a child therapist is creating that same environment and atmosphere for the parent, because a lot of times as parents, you're coming into parenting maybe with your own trauma history or your own lack of parenting skills. And so a child therapist really has to build a bond and connect with the parents as well, just to be able to give that parent feedback and help the parent understand how to do this differently with their child.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, you don't want to blame the parent, right?
And, no.
And a lot of, you know, a lot of probably one of the things that happens the most, unfortunately, is that you get a kid who's acting out in a certain way and it's reflective. You know, you think, well, what'd the parent do? Right? So parents are reluctant, I think, to come in with their kid and say, I don't know what to do with my child. And a lot of times some of the mistakes you've made will come out, and we all make them. That's humans being human, right? So to come and be vulnerable is really courageous. And to get your kid help early is super important. I get a lot of kids, and you do too, 14, 15, 16. Mm-hmm. They're already way behind academically. Socially, they're isolated. They've gotten into gaming at a high level. They're checked out from their parents. Maybe they're smoking pot. And many of these young people were showing stuff at 7, 8, 9. So what would you say to parents who are waiting? Like, well, it's just a phase. How do they know what's a phase, what's not a phase developmentally? It's just a 9-year-old.
Right. So if a child's behaviors don't resolve with some positive parenting interventions and trying to connect with your child, then I would say it's not a phase. It's if it progresses longer than, you know, a few months. And it typically, if it's something that needs attention, it will get worse. And so you want to just kind of watch for that. But I would like parents just to really understand that these events that take place in a kid's life can, if unprocessed, they will just kind of create more and more and more. And you don't want a teenager that has to go to therapy because they're, you know, so disconnected from their parents and they're smoking pot and they're skipping school. And it's much easier to deal with the child's stressors and anxiety and depression and traumas when they're 6, 7, 8 than it is when they're 14, 15.
And when we're talking about trauma, I just want to go back real quickly to something you said about little T's and big T's. It used to be PTSD really was thought of as war, watching a murder, some huge event
yes.
that caused something. But now we're really starting to learn that accumulation of small, you mentioned bullying. I've had a lot of kids in my office as teenagers that are still dealing with 5, 6, 7-year-old getting bullied at school for a year, and it's stuck with them.
Mm-hmm.
And these are like little cumulative small traumas. People get confused because of the word trauma, but it is an adverse childhood experience that collects and
yes.
they build. And can you talk a little bit about the foundational event in childhood, like mental health? Like, what is that theory about the cornerstone event or the thing that sort of sets that negative cognition, that negative belief about self in place, and then
right.
how it's reinforced?
Yeah, so... So it's really important to take a child in the assessment process and help them remember what we call the touchstone memory. Like, when did that first take place? Because oftentimes, if you can go back and resolve that touchstone memory, then the brain will kind of reprocess everything on its own easier. And so I don't know if we have time to get into EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, but it's a really interesting trauma intervention. And when used with kids, it can make processing of traumas very fast.
Well, let's talk for a minute about it. Tell folks what EMDR is briefly.
So EMDR uses bilateral stimulation through eye movements, and it desensitizes emotional material that was upsetting, and it reprocesses negative core beliefs that one holds about themselves. And essentially, going back to the neurobiology of the brain, it helps the right and left hemisphere reprocess that memory through eye movements or different forms of bilateral stimulation.
And it's based on the theory of REM sleep, right? Rapid eye
yes.
movement, where your eyes move back and forth during a time when they believe that information is being stored and processed in different parts of the brain.
Yes, and it helps access the memory.
Right.
And bring it to the conscious, and then goes back into the memory, and then brings it back to the conscious. And it's a process it's pretty impressive how it reprocesses old memories.
I tell people, if you want to think about EMDR, go back to your kindergarten class that you went to school in, and you walk in, and everything looks really tiny, right? The stools look tiny, and the toilet's really little, and you're like, how did I ever sit on that toilet? But
yeah.
And all the lockers are small, but you don't remember. I mean, you look at them now, and they're like, those are so little, but in your memory, they're big.
Yeah.
And that's the same way that childhood memories they're stored as they happen.
Yes.
Not as the adult is seeing them. So in EMDR, if I'm correct, the idea is we pull that memory back from long-term storage, which is different than short-term storage, and we sort of bring it to the consciousness, infuse some adaptive thinking in it, and then put it back.
Right. And we also have to remember that the body is storing all of this experience as well through your five senses. And so it's really interesting. I work with an adult, and she processes all of her memories through physiological sensations. And so she will process sinus pain, and she will process neck pain, and she'll process pressure in her sternum. And then the memory is resolved. It's very interesting.
Yeah, Dr. Vander Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score, is mm-hmm. a really good book on trauma and recovery, and he talks about the whole body as being integrated. And people who experience a lot of trauma, like statistically are obese, like much higher rate, heart disease, strokes, early death. And that's all linked to childhood trauma, all the chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, all those things are much more common in people with trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all mind-body stuff.
Yes.
So I guess the important thing about children is if you can get in there early and repair some of that damage, be they little T's or big T's, unintentional or intentional, they have a much better chance of functioning better as teenagers and adults.
Yes, and making it fun so there's no shame around it.
Shame's a big one.
It's the biggest block. It's the biggest barrier to mental health.
Across the board, addiction, depression, anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
People don't want to talk about this stuff.
Yes.
If more people talked about it, more people would probably be willing to get help, right?
I think so, because again, it's back to attachment and providing support for each other.
Yeah, I mean, we suffer in isolations.
And, yes.
And I mean, secrets keep us sick. Okay. I guess the last thing, we talked a little bit about EMDR, and you're doing trauma work. EMDR is a specific thing. It's a specific intervention, but there's other interventions for trauma work. What other kind of things are you working with besides EMDR?
Well, play therapy has its own trauma resolution process to it. And so when kids play stories out, the more traumatized a child is, the more what we call non-directed that you can be. And you kind of just sit back and you become the child's mirror and the story plays out and you're reflecting exactly what the child is doing, exactly how the story is unfolding. And you're reflecting back themes and patterns. And then many times a child will just process through the trauma and get to resolution on their own just by tracking and reflecting the story to them and holding their safe emotional space with them. Sometimes you have to be more directive, and you don't ever want a child to stay stuck in their story and just play trauma over and over and over and over again. And so that's a danger in somebody not knowing what they're doing.
You mean they have to find some resolution?
Yes, they have to find resolution. And so sometimes we can help the child find resolution through wondering about if there's a resource that would come in, or wondering what a stronger voice would sound like, or wondering what that character feels like in their body to create that distance. So we're not talking about the child themselves, but maybe we're talking about the little mouse and where the child feels scared in their body and with the little mouse as the metaphor. And so play therapy is definitely a trauma resolution intervention.
It sounds like it's also about adaptive. All of this stuff, even CBT and like all the stuff that we do, is adaptive, like information reprocessing, right? It's taking new information and putting it with an old thought or an old belief and helping people to understand that that's not accurate.
Yes.
And kids, I mean, their brains, how they interpret things and how they see things, that's one of the things as adults we don't understand, because I don't think we can remember it. But how we internalize information can be completely off of what it was supposed to be, right? I mean, kids internalize things based on how they perceive them.
All the time, I see that. I tell parents, things sit in your child's brain in really funny ways because they don't have the resources and understanding of the world that you do. And so a parent can be tired and grumpy and come home from work and not want to play with their child. And the child feels like, well, I'm not very important to them. But that's not it at all.
No.
The parent's coming home tired and grumpy, and they're stressed out from their job and their life. And so they don't spend time with their kid. What their kid is hearing is, I'm not loved, or I'm not important. And what the parent is saying is, I'm stressed, but nothing's being communicated back and forth to help the child resolve that core belief.
And we get so busy in our lives that we fail to realize that a lot of the times the attention that we pay on our kids or pay to our kids are when they're acting out, as opposed to when they're acting well.
Kids right? will act out to let you know that they need some time.
And if that's the only kind of attention they're getting, they will do it a lot.
Yes.
Yeah. What about parents who have the kids that are just so difficult in their home but nowhere else? I have that a lot. I don't know, why is he like this here? He's great at school. Other parents love him. Why is he so difficult?
Yeah. Well, I start with by telling parents that it's really a form of flattery that the kids can be angry with them because they know that
they feel so safe.
Yeah, they feel safe and they feel unconditionally loved. They know the parent is not going to go away. So sometimes the stress that the kids are carrying at school comes home on the parents. And what gets in the way is the parent's reaction to that child, to their child's defiance or acting out. And so not really getting at what's the underlying feelings. So if parents can take a moment and just kind of explore their child's feelings, that's a great place to start. And sometimes I'll encourage parents to make a feelings poster at home, or I'll encourage them to, you know, create a feelings game at home, turn Candyland into a feelings game by making each of the different colors a different feeling, just really becoming a feelings family and being able to talk about things. A great time to do that is car rides or
we got about 20 bedtime. Seconds. Can you talk about, real briefly, the importance of parents being present, what that means, and intentional in their parenting. Really present.
Really present. I think the biggest thing is putting your phones down. Hmm. Parents are very guilty of hearing a conversation with a child but not connecting through their eyes. I think eye contact and touch and time one-on-one is really critical.
All right. Okay, my thanks. Today's guest, Lori Houston, I really appreciate you coming on today. It's been fun.
Sure, it's been awesome. Thanks.
It's good seeing you again after many years.
Yeah.
Feels like it wasn't that long ago. We have a variety of links and information about today's topic on the show page. Just go to alaskapublic.org and find the link for Line 1. Today's conversation and all our past Line 1 programs can be found on our archives. You find the link to our show under the radio tab at alaskapublic.org. If you'd like to continue today's conversation, please join us on Facebook, and you can find that link also on our website at alaskapublic.org. Please remember there's two showings coming up of Screenagers, which I will be moderating. They're sponsored by the Winterberry Charter School Parent Guild. First showing is Friday, May 5th. I said 6th earlier. It's the 5th at the Beartooth Theater. The second one will be at the Anchorage Waldorf School. Tickets are $5 at the door for both shows. Well, there's significant evidence that exposure to adverse childhood experiences is linked to risky health behaviors, chronic health conditions, low life potential, and early death. As the number of adverse childhood experiences increases, so does the risk for these outcomes. On next week's program, Dr. Woodard and his guests discuss the Matsu Health Foundation's report on combating child maltreatment. That's Monday, May 8th at 2 p.m. Eric Bork handled the web editing for today's program, and Dave Waldron was the man behind the glass. For all of us at Line 1, thanks for taking the time to join us. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.